Hello and welcome to Matt's Truck and Grep podcast. Matt Ireland here once again. Just a quick word before we start. Many thanks to our very kind sponsors and everyone who's kindly donated via Patreon and buymeacoffee.com. As I said before, it all really does help. And if you're in a position to donate, please, please consider it. And also, if you could give us a like, a rate and a review wherever you're listening to your podcast, it all really does help. Anyway, enough of that. We are on to today's guest. It's a good friend of mine and a well-travelled Scotsman, Jim Horn. Jim, how you doing?
Fine, Matt. How are you, pal?
I'm all right, mate. I'm not too bad. What, you been up to much today?
No, I've just been kind of messing about, day off today, so in the workshop for till about 8, 9 o'clock tonight, and that's as far as it goes today. I'm actually on a week off from the driving. Family issues is preventing us doing what we were supposed to be doing, some health issues.
Fair enough, mate.
So one of these things.
Yeah, sorry to hear that, mate. So, well, let's go right back to the start, and how, if we can remember back that far, how on earth did you end up in transport? Is there a family connection, or how...
Going away back to the start, I suppose my granddad originally had a bakery in our town of Bowness, and they had a few shops. And due to a bent accountant, things didn't turn out the way they were meant to do. And it turned out that both him and my dad turned to driving trucks before he needed an HGV. And so there we are, from 5 years old, going with them or whatever they were doing. And granddad was often driving them little BMC FGs with the lower windows and the doors that you could drive with them open. So yep. There'd be 3, 5, 6, 7 year olds in the passenger side with the doors open, flying along as fast as it could go. No seat belts, nothing like that, no health and safety whatsoever. So for that age, we were actually jumping in the back of the van and handballing stuff off. So at 7 years old, we were handballing car batteries and stuff like that. And ended up that it was like the full package, you know, with the driving, the handballing, everything became natural to us. And in the 70s, Dad took his HGV. We were doing trunk runs to Aberdeen. And then he moved to another firm, Campbell's in Linlithgow. Ended up doing some European for Barbara European while driving for him. Daycab Scania 110, Italy and stuff like that. So, yeah, it basically... born into it, if you like. You know, I would get rid of the school as much as I could to go with Dad, Granddad, one of the uncles, and actually relish the manual handling side of things as well. I've seen all the places that you could go, and obviously loved the night out in the car, but it was something different. Nobody else was doing that. Now, ended up that I realised that what I wanted to do was be an owner-driver, and the only way I could do that was for 21 years old. Needed something to fill in from 16, because there ain't no way I was staying a day longer at school than I possibly
had. That makes two of us.
So the only thing was that I got a job that quick. I only got 2 weeks of school holidays that year. That was a bit of a dissy. So I ended up working as an apprentice with Daft Trucks Scotland, or Scotia Daft Trucks as it was then. And, you know, I did my apprenticeship serving on 21, 23, 2500 and 28 and 3300 dafts.
Right.
Got to know a lot of the salesmen, got to know a lot of owner drivers, guys that had done the Middle East, all that type of thing. I ended up working a lot for the sales department, fitting all the fifth wheels, wings, and, you know, presenting the tractor unit for the customer. Got to know some of the customers with delivering the tractor units, you know, just as the van driver to bring the salesman back. And I ended up, I just thought, right, this is the way for me. And then things changed. Dad had reopened the bakery again. It was like printing money, to be honest with you. Granddad, who worked for him, had a crash in his car, broke his neck. And Dad asked me if I could dump the last of my apprenticeship and go and work with him. And I says, well, didn't know what to replace Granddad, obviously. And he says, well, no, I'm going to put a mobile shop on the road and I need somebody you can trust with an open till. So Bedford CF mobile shop was my truck after that, and admittedly, I did turn it into a big success. I mean, we were drawing, I can say it now because it's so many years ago, £1,000 a week, and we were selling rolls at 4p, pies were 16p, and cakes were 10p. So I was moving a lot of stuff.
Yeah, clearly. Did you miss the apprenticeship when you jacked it in and being in the environment around it?
Honestly, mate, no, really. I did not fit in too well with some of the guys at DAF. Turned out when I went there, I was too keen, if you like, to learn. I already could strip an engine. I could take a gearbox out and do a clutch when I was 16 anyway, because my dad had crap old cars and we were always taking them to bits and putting them back together again.
Yeah.
So I started at the apprenticeship that I knew more than any other apprentices. And then during our block release at Livingston Motec, I started to fall behind because our practical side and daft, we were doing too much cleaning. I know we were apprentices, but you know, you could see your face in the tiles in the pit and even on the grease barrels. And that was every morning till break time at 10:30. And then I ended up, because they found out I could weld, I ended up doing all these trucks for the sales department. And it ended up, I never really, maybe worked on a couple engine rebuilds, but never got one to myself, if you know what I mean.
Right, got you.
I just felt I wasn't fitting in. But what also happened then, we'd made plans to get married, the wife and I, and Daft was only like 7 miles away. And I was only on £52 a week, it was gross, 1982 that would be. And Daft were moving to Cumbernauld, which just on triple the petrol alone was going to scupper any plans for being married on them type of wages. My wages went from £52 a week gross to £100 a week in my hand immediately with my dad, and then 120. And then when I showed what the van could do, I was up to 150 in 1983. That was my clear wage, 150. Tanker drivers were going on strike. I've got a motor transport for them for £138 a week gross, plus the bonuses. So I was earning that running around the doors. A lot of hours and stuff like that. I mean, the gearbox was prone to go and them things. I mean, I would get it back at the end of its run, empty it, clean it, jack it up, take the gearbox out, put another one back in and be on the road in the morning again. that was how it had to be done. I could not let my customers down. You know, they were mostly pensioners who at that time never had cars. Pensioners nowadays have got cars, but back then they didn't have. So anyway, it was the usual family things, you know. Wasn't completely getting on with my brother, and my mother didn't like me taking half the stuff away at lunchtime to restock the van. And what I used to say to her was, look, Mum, if I get to a place, if somebody comes to your shop at 5 o'clock at night and there's nothing left, that's their problem. You've been open since 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, they've had like 22 hours to come and get their stuff.
Exactly.
But if I arrive at somebody's house at 5 p.m. with nothing left, that's my fault, no theirs, because that's the time I get to them. I couldn't make Mum see that, and God love her, we were fighting on, you know, fighting over apple tarts and stuff every day. And with a bit of tension with my brother, I thought, bollocks to this, I'm getting out of here. So local haulage contractor that I knew was starting to wind his sale down, put this old Berlet up for sale at a really stupid amount of money for what it was worth, to be fair. But when I went and spoke to him, he would leave it on his operator's license, still I got mine. We shouldn't be saying that. He would leave it insured because it was still in his name anyway, and there was 6 months road tax left on it. And he would work me, and he would pay me at the end of every month for that month. So, you know, the first of the month, I was paid right up till the 31st of the month. Prior to that, I was quick with invoice. So you can't argue with that. And if you draw diesel on them as well. And it made it a lot easier for me to start, although I was paying for it through the price of the truck.
Yeah.
But I also got four 40-foot trailers, one of which was a 60-foot extender. And they were free of charge. He paid for any service and upkeep of them. And that's how I did it. I just bought the truck 6 weeks after my 21st birthday. Found some casual drivers for it, and I kept going with the van until the December of that year, December 1984, when I managed to get my HGV. So,
right.
Well, 3rd of January 1985, it was, now's time to learn, Jim, you're on your own.
So you actually were an owner-driver as such without even driving the truck, and you were employing somebody to drive it.
Yeah.
But before you actually drove it yourself. I mean, that is seriously entrepreneurial, isn't it? And also, again, it's a good reflection on the guy you bought the truck off as well, to actually give you a head start and a helping hand just to get you going and underway.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I would never say anything, but John Meikle was the guy's name. And when he did finally wind up, it also came with a pallet contract that he had had. That was new pallets from Tilgate Pallets, a place called Winsborough near us. And you'd be running to normally United Glass at Alloa, ICI and Grangemouth. And then some would go into ICI in Stevenson and would put some down near the borders. All the distance work was carried out by GR Steens, who were the brick and sort of, they did clay pipes and stuff. They were actually doing the the Stocktons and stuff for the price of the diesel. That was the start of the rot. Way back in 1983, a company like that, doing it for the price of diesel and get them back home again. And there were, you know, they made their own stuff. They never needed to actually have the haulage side making money as haulage, like, you know. So anyway, it came with that, and that worked well for me as well, because that was me also having direct work from day one. That was mine and nobody else's, although local contractor was trying to steal it. And, you know, in between times, he was my best pal. Yeah, sending me south. Got a backload for you tonight, Jim. Maybe tomorrow. What do you mean, maybe tomorrow? Well, maybe tomorrow means it might be the next day. And then by the time you get to Southampton home, it's the next day for tipping it. There was no 24-hour tipping back in them days, Mark. You'll understand that. Or weekend work. And then I would phone home and find out there were pallets the next day, and he was trying to steal them. So, did things we shouldn't do, and it would come back to Southampton that night, and it would be on the pallets in the morning. And there's no way somebody was stealing that work.
And it's something's never changed in transport, does it, really?
it's exactly the same. You just look through the history books and find it's been the same from day one.
Yep. So, I mean, when you started out as an owner-driver, did you have plans to actually do European and distance work, or are you just sort of quite happy pottering around locally? Because that's generally where the money is. It's kind of better there, isn't it?
Well, generally for me, it was because I had that pallet job, I was going to stay on that. And that meant I bought a second truck, because this other chap, as I say, was trying to steal the work. So hatched up a little plan. I bought this other truck. It was a V8, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
But it had a Ford badge on the front end and a little V-series cab on it. And we decided all I was going to do was leave that in the pallet yard. And the four trailers were there. And if the work came on and I was away, my dad would actually, when he was finished in the bakery at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he would go, and any trailers that were loaded, he would tie them up and drag them outside into the little side road outside it. And then when I came home, I would go and tip them. And that was what it was designed for. And then it hardly ever moved below the pallets, because Tilgate Pallet relocated to their head office in, I can't mind now, the south, down Sussex or somewhere it was, and offered me to go down there. And I went, no, I'm staying where I am. So picked up some local engineering work and stuff like that. I was never one for wanting to do UK distance, but I did fancy the continent. And that came about by chance. I mean, basically, the little D-Series 4 don't last you 3 months, and somebody pulled it in front of my driver and it got written off. Driver was okay, but the truck was completely demolished. So we parked that up and I was just running the one, but I got the chance to a workshop as well. So I started a friend of mine who became like a brother-in-law, and he was a mechanic in it. We started an apprentice who is now one of the well-known drivers in this area. Shout out for the Catman if he's listening. He drives a tipper for the demolition company now. I'd give that guy a job anywhere. Turned out to be a great guy. Anyway, we were working the workshop, and then a mate of mine, Robert Hunter, who had actually been doing some clearinghouse work for this chap that was trying to steal my pallet work, Robert came to me and he says, right, I'm wanting to start clearinghouse. Can I get an office in your garage? Yeah, no problem. And then he says, well, I've got this mate in Doncaster, Jim Houston Transport. He's running the John Carr doors and windows stuff. We could be doing our base in Scotland. So off I trotted and bought an F7. So that'll be the man for the job. And we were working at 24/7. I was working in the garage through the day. And then on a Monday night, I would go and do a Washington and Butler trunk, followed by a Belford trunk. And the day man would go out there and pick them off. And I'd do the same on a Wednesday, a Washington Butler trunk followed by a Belford trunk, and back in the workshop the next day. And then on the Friday, I would go to Doncaster and back, do a complete round trip. Sometimes used to take somebody with me on that to share the driving, because it wasn't quite right. And we were doing okay at that. And then the guy who was working for says that the work was drying up, and obviously I've got to be the first one to go. So I went, and he bought to sell a brand new F-16 Globetrotter. You know, the work was drying up. Yeah, okay, it was that. So anyway, there was another mate of mine who, this goes way back, this is where we go in circles now. When my dad was with St Ibals, he was the Aberdeen trunk, and the changeover guy in Aberdeen became a family friend. We still would be, passed away 3 years ago. We're still friends with his wife and his three sons. And he had started doing continental work. And well, I knew he was because his truck was on my operator's license. So I knew he was doing that. So he got his own CPC, you know, it was only a temporary thing. And he just says to me one day, you know, fancy day in Spain. I went, aye. And that was it. It was like a 30-second thought process. It wasn't even 30 seconds. So the week later, there was me. I'm down in Scunthorpe for our offshore transport services, and I'm off to Spain.
Right.
Took a driver with me, the one that had the accident in the D-Series, because he was going to be doing a bit of driving. Got stuck in a customs strike there, the British customs strike, actually. Got stuck at Plymouth on the way back in, so we hired a car, because we thought we'd make loads of money at this. So we hired a car, the two of us, and we brought two of John Amet's drivers up, dropped them in the Midlands, came up the road, and Gordon was going down the next week to tip the truck, reload it back to Spain. And I thought, well, while he's doing that, I'll go and hire another F7. So it's another unsuitable truck for Spain. And off we trotted with that as well. The only thing was, Gordon got a job he'd applied for months ago in Northampton and never took another truck to Spain. Ah. So I had to phone one of my uncles and say, any chance of taking a week off your work? Why? I says, I need somebody to go to Spain. So my uncle Dougie dropped out of his day in, and away the two of us went to Spain. And as I've said to a few guys, it was just to see if we could lose twice as much money with one truck as we lost with two trucks as we lost with one truck.
You know? And did you? Right.
Yeah. Did that. But the funny thing was, the little F7 that we hired it off Alec Anderson in Bowness. His trucks are famous through all the truck shows. Hired it off of him, but my dad's uncle had driven it since brand new in the local timber yard that it was in. So right. The truck still had a connection to us all the way back to then as well, you know. We've got a lot of things that intertwine round about, you know, and it's nothing to do with breeding. It's nothing to do with breeding now, Matt. It's just coincidence, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. So how long did the European venture last then? If you were clearly losing money, but I presume you're enjoying it at the same time as well.
Oh, I loved it, mate. Absolutely loved it. It was party time as well, you know. Some of the time, I mean, when I was 26, I had six trucks on the go. Because with F7, and then the F7, I took a driver out with me to drive it, and because I was going to get another truck. And he seemed okay. So he went out on his second trip, and I bought an F88 this time. So I had it in to get painted. And the driver, unfortunately, managed to go down four gears instead of into top gear. And took the crankshaft out. So that was that knacker, but and I never had the F88 on the road yet. So a mate of mine had an old Scania 111, and he was there in Spain for me for OTS, but through me again while he was getting his CPC. And he had an unfortunate encounter in Spain, and he witnessed a shooting. And his bottle went and came out of Spain empty with his permit. So that was permit wasted. And he got sent in to bring the truck up the road, got there. Driver was out of his face, spent all the running money. And the French police were sitting in the lay-by waiting on him turning up with a chain so he wouldn't let him pull it. So he just brought the driver back. And then him and I went out the following week with his truck, got a load out there, low loader, stuck the F7 on the back and brought it back home again. This time the F88's out of the paint shop, so I'm away with that. So I went back to one truck again. But when I was running the F88, I got an offer of putting a concrete mixer on the RMC through a mate of mine. And when I went to see the guy, he says, yeah, but we're not really taking any on. How do you feel about taking on all the tippers we're going to be doing? You know, I think it would be 10 tippers or something. So anyway, a bigger tipper company took that out. And I says to the wife, look, I'm going to do this. We need to do it right. I'm going to go and buy a new truck. So I looked at it, I knew it would be an Iveco or a Renault because everything else was too expensive. We worked out that if it was doing enough miles, the difference in fuel consumption between the F88 and the Iveco, as it turned out, would actually pay the finance on it.
Right.
Plus the thing as well is, let's face it, with F88, you were not getting to Portsmouth at 10 hours.
No.
That was a hard do. Turbostar, 8¾ hours, we had them briefs. And on legal speeds all the way, but keeping it there. So I says, right, we'll need to do this. So I put a deposit down on it. And 2 weeks after I put a deposit down, I got offered a mixer. Oh, it's odds law, eh? So I took the mixer on, and I had to get the same uncle and say to him, right, I need you on this. I had to buy him out of the bus company that I put him through his PSV so he could come and do that. So he went and did that. The Iveco came, that and the F88 were still running. And then decided a bit later. I think it was probably after maybe a cancelled session at Quads, where quite a lot of drink was involved with a few drivers, that I decided I would buy another truck. So I bought Mick Denson's Scania 112 off him. And while we were at that same kind of drunken stupor, I decided to buy Dave Croft's left-hand drive Turkish spec DAF 300 as well.
Well, why not?
Yeah, why not? It's only another couple of beers and you're ready to buy anything, you know. So Dave decided he was keeping it for his son, Neil. So anyway, I went and bought a mate of mine that used to have the 111. He bought himself a DAF locally. Somebody never paid him. He ended up going to the wall. So I bought the DAF with him. So I ended up with that. Meanwhile, I've got the guy, Big J, and the Aki board that are there on local work. Well, one at a time on local work, split with F88 and the concrete mixer. So I've got six running by this time. Still not had any wages. I bought a new car for the wife because we were planning on a kid and wanted a decent car. So a new Mercedes came, and one of the drivers said to me, "Hey, you couldn't afford to get a wage rise, and you've got that new BMW sitting there." I said, "That's a Mercedes, mate. It's not a BMW." I says, "I'll tell you what," I says, "we'll swap your wages for mine." I says, "That's my wages sitting there. It's £80 a week." I says, "and it's against the business, so I'll get money back on that." Anyway, I'll keep working for what I'm working for. To be fair, Matt, I knew when I was starting drivers, on the rates we were getting with OTS, I was never going to be able to pay top wages. The guys knew that right from the start, and I fully accepted that I would be training up drivers to go into European work and then move on to a bit of a bigger paying company. I've not got an issue with that. I knew that's what was going to happen. And that's why when I advertised for drivers, I took drivers off the dole rather than out to another job because I felt, well, you know, the guy on the dole is not got anything to lose. The wages are no brilliant. There's no chance of no being paid. I mean, it's always going to pay them. And they would always know the rate before starting. But it was never going to be top whack. So I accepted that, and away we went with it. That was me, still in European. However, you asked how long it lasted. November the 30th, 1990, a young driver came. He'd been annoying me for 6 months to get a job. Wouldn't take him on. 23-year-old, no experience. Driving a mobile library, a 7.5-ton Iveco mobile library. Wouldn't take him on because of the old adage, you know, a bit of experience and stuff. Even though I started myself from scratch. But he sounded a good guy. And then just one day when I needed a driver, he just appeared in my garage. And he says, "I'm Andrew Jennison." I says, "All right." I says, "Still looking for a job?" "Yeah." I says, "See that Iveco there?" I says, "Go and take that up to the petrol station. I've got an account there. Fill it up with diesel. Come back down. Hook it up to that trailer. Back that trailer in the early pit." I says, "I've got stuff I'm needing today." So the guy just went and done it. So he jumps out of the truck and he went, I says, "It's no other fat." He says, "I can't see the fat." I says, "It's a guessing game, mate. You can't see. You've got to pull the mirrors and go in the door." So anyway, he was fine at that. So I took him in. I says, "Look, you really want to do this?" He went, "Aye." I says, "Right, okay." Taught him what the wages would be. I says, "Here we go. Go out with Hamish." So away we went. He jumped in the Scania with Hamish. I jumped in the Iveco. Two of us loaded for curries. And away we went to Spain. We were stuck in a Spanish driver's blockade at the French border. And they were going different place for me. I ended up, my mate, Dave Sisson from Carlisle, who sadly passed away when he was a young man, him and I just decided we were having a go with it. So we just, you know, broke into Spain and went in and got dipped and loaded and back out again while everybody was still sitting about, or most people anyway. Bit of desperation, to be fair. But we made Hamish and Andy sit because we never wanted them getting any difficulties. So anyway, we got back, and they got back as well because they went and tipped in France. As it turned out, they just diverted the tyres from Spain to France and tipped them at a different factory there. And I says to Andy, "Well, you'll only be wanting to do this now." Then he went, "Oh, I'm loving it." I says, "Right, okay." So he went back out, two trucks, him driving one, him is driving another. And I think he'd done two trips like that, and then one where somebody chaperoned him out and he had to find his own way back. And then he went out on his fifth trip. And he had Heister forklifts on. He delivered them down through Spain, three drops, obviously. Went and got his load of fruit on, and unfortunately, and you know, it's worse to this day, he had a fatal RTA and never came home. So that was it. I said, "Well, I'm not employing anybody now. I'm not going to be responsible." No, it was nothing I could do about it. He was driving the truck. He'd had 15 hours off. There was no hassle with that. The truck was 100% mechanical. It always was. Every time my trucks came into the continent, they went over the pit because I still had that same mechanic working for me. Every trip, it wasn't the 6 weekly checks. It was every time they came in, you know. I didn't want them breaking down over there.
Yeah.
And so that was it for me. And I put a guy that was doing British International on it. He wanted to do it for Great Transfer, whereas you just tax the truck as tractor unit as private, and you just ship over to Cannes with a trailer on out to Portsmouth, and then you do 6 trips to Portugal and back, and then you bring the unit home for a week, have a week off, and then go back out again.
Right.
And that's what he was doing with British International, and that's what he wanted to do with me. So we did that. We outbased it to Canterbury, and the mixer was still going strong, but my mixer driver wanted to become an owner driver, so we wanted to start a family. So it stood to reason, get rid of everything, keep the Iveco on that job, and, you know, get the keep the mixer. So that was 1991, late 1991, and the freight transfer job, typical, payment terms were getting longer, rates were getting lower, and I said to him, this is no paying, it's no working. Put him on Curry's, didn't like the UK side of getting to the boat and back, and he just chucked it, so we put the truck up. A lease transfer, but that, you know, that's another story. That's a big story on its own. And we ended up with just the one truck then. And then when the contract was up on that, there was no other work for it. Had a disagreement with Redimax, quite a big disagreement with them. Decided I had enough. And since then, I've been driving tankers. So I've now been 31 years on tankers.
So you've packed up as such, what,
1991, mate, yeah.
That 1991.
Was four and a half years or something was all we did continental for. It was 10 and a half years on my own trucks. And yeah, then I've been 31 years, as I say, on tankers since then.
This episode of Matt's Truck and Grab Podcast is proudly brought to you by the Retro Show Ireland. Happening on Sunday the 28th of June at the showgrounds, Athy, County Kildare, with registration from lunchtime Saturday, there'll be a barbecue with live music and full bar Saturday night. This is open for trucks registered from 2005 and older. It's promising to be a great weekend celebrating classic retro and vintage trucks. There's trade space still available, and for more information, call or WhatsApp Kevin on +353 86 853 7691. That's +353 86 853 7691. I mean, that was a hell of a roller coaster from your sort of early 20s and that 10 years of expansion, reduction, expansion, and yeah, just, you know, must have been pretty stressful as well at the time with employing people and things like that.
Well, see when you're in your early 20s there, nothing bothers you except for the guy getting killed. That was the one thing. Nothing else bothered me. Everything else was, you know, it wasn't a problem. You found a solution, and that was it. Yeah. It was always a solution. Yeah. But, you know, hats off to my wife. She was at the same time, obviously, she's a year older than me. So she'd be maybe 25, 26 at the time. She was working full time at an electronics place, and she knew where the trucks were. There's no mobile phones then. Well, I did have one, but you can imagine this thing. It's the size of a car battery. You sling it over your shoulder. It's got the little flip-up rubber duck aerial on it, and the handset's got a cord on it.
And they never
worked anyway, but I've still got that. That cost me £2,000 in 1989 or 90. £2,000, I think it was. It was £1,600 plus the finance or something. It was about £2,000. So, yeah, so she knew where everything was. Drivers would phone her. She would tell me when I would phone in where they were. And basically, she was a diamond. She actually kept these things running when I wasn't even there. I mean, wow. such things like, I had an accident in Spain with Iveco, and I got picked up with my uncle, another uncle who was driving the Scania. And we just double-manned it to Portugal, tipped it, and then up to La Coruña, loaded it and back. And then my truck got brought back, fixed, and we were back on the road again. But she coordinated him to come and pick me up where I was at the police station in Victoria. And there was another time when my truck got wrecked on the ferry, absolutely demolished on the ferry. It was a very rough crossing, 36 hours from Cannes to Portsmouth. If Frank Tank's listening, he was on it with me. His truck never got damaged, but mine got written off. but it was my sort of sister-in-law, come niece, is wedding the 40. the following day after we got back, I got my truck towed off at Portsmouth. I stepped out of the cab and there was a Scania waiting. He came into Dover, got diverted to Portsmouth, and he was sitting waiting on me. So straight up the road, and I made the wedding the next day. that's all due to a wife who knows virtually nothing about trucks. But, yeah. You know, she could do that. She could, you know, she knew where we were, and she could coordinate it within her work and everything, and just basically kept everything holding together.
Yeah.
She got that good at it. There was one night I went into Clods, national, the Relay de Saint-Onge on the National 137, 85 kilometres north of Bordeaux there. Most drivers that's done European will know exactly where it is. Many a headache being found in that place, like. And so I goes in, diesels up, puts the truck around the back, parks it up, and as I stepped in the restroom door at the bar, the woman that owned it, Annette, handed me the phone. She says, "Jim, your wife is on the phone." I went, "Well, bloody hell. I must have a tracker on me somewhere."
I reckon so.
That's how good she was at me, Matt. By the time she figured out my runs, that's how good she was at coordinating where I was, like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, fair play to her. So did you venture away from Spain and Portugal? You know, did you do some Italy or to the east or anything like that?
I only ever did one Italy. I was supposed to be going to Malta with OTS, but the first time he offered me Malta, he wanted me to ship out on something like the 28th of December for a 6th of January trip. And I went, Ship me out on the 2nd of January. I says, "I'm not sitting at Clusies on my Todd, you know, for 3 days waiting on traffic moving or whatever." So I declined that, and I never really got another offer of Malta. And we had a Tunisia on, and I was actually in the vehicle when it cancelled.
Oh, God.
Just turned around to go home again, mate. It's cancelled. All right. That was oil field work for you, Matt. Hot shot stuff. You know, that was good work. I mean, I did one in Holland with old F88 with an 8-ton blow pressure valve on the back. Gets off the ferry, drives straight to the place, goes in and got this for you, desperately needing it, you know. And the guy goes, wait a minute, and he's on the phone and he comes back, "Take it back, we no longer need it."
the whole oil field work is just, it's mad, isn't it? You know, some of the stuff that I've had calls from the various companies down here, you know, or can you just go and do this, and, you know, like, can you go to Luxembourg and tip on Christmas Day and all things like that, and then all of a sudden the problem goes away mysteriously.
That's exactly that's what happened there. Just took it back to Aberdeen again. Easiest load I've ever done. Go back with the ferret.
Yeah.
And you get the same money for that as if you're stuck for a week waiting on a backload.
Yeah, exactly.
But that was, I suppose, the social side of the European world. I mean, to answer your question first, we did do, not in any great quantity, some Frances, Belgium, Holland, Germany, Italy, Austria, Switzerland. I had one on Austria for quite a while, actually. And he did a few Swisses off of that as well. Did jib a few times, other than that, with Spain and Portugal. I did want to go further afield, but I'm one of these guys that, although working for like offshore was never paying great money, and neither was Curry's, you knew you were going to get paid though. And you got comfortable working with them, you trust them, you see. And that kind of takes away the ambition to go and try something else. It's been a bit like the tankers. I could have went and done some Middle East probably with Nick Bull and people like that. But because you've got a job that's paying good money, you don't want to leave it.
So, no, especially when you're in your position with a young family and commitments and stuff like that. When you've got the security of a well-paying job with good, bound to have had a good pension and other benefits like the holiday and blah, 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 it is a very tough call to leave that to chase a dream that could potentially leave you without a house, essentially, or even a wife.
that's right, mate. And I've got to say, well, that's us being married this year will be 43 years. So she's either a glutton for punishment or we did things kind of the right way.
I'm not passing a judgment.
Well, you know what I'm like, so you probably haven't already passed that judgment.
So how did you end up getting onto the tankers then, Jim? Is it just an advert or friends or something like that?
My wife, believe it or not, again. What it was when we packed up with the mixer, there'd been an accusation of stealing concrete.
Right.
To be fair, I was probably the only one that couldn't steal concrete because I never knew how to batch it. But my brother had a shed, and in that shed was my F88, my Aki Borderer, and a couple of other things. and it was a dirt floor on a farm. And things had changed in the concrete business. The environmental protection agencies were now charging them to dump concrete in the landfill. So all the customers were having to be charged if they sent anything back. So when you've got a customer buying millions of pounds worth of concrete a year and then getting charged £60 a cube to dump it, they're not happy about that. So the result was that we were going to the BP site where a lot of our work was, and mixers would be there at 10, 11 o'clock at night. And you'd be sitting there scarting about with joiners, making up a box to get rid of a metre of concrete, you know, around a lamppost or something like that. And the batcher would need to wait in case you needed another metre to finish the job off. And it became an absolute nightmare. And I say to everybody involved, look, I've got that shed up there. Can I just take the return concrete for that? And that was welcomed to the customers, right across Redimix and everything, until somebody decided to tell security I was stealing it. Right. And then security came in, and then they all denied me. No, we never told them we could take it. It's like, well, you know, and we were caught between a rock and a hard place. But eventually I did win my case. But my truck was out of contract, and they had a field full of brand new Ford cargoes lying there, £1,300 a month, and there was no work. And my little Leyland was already bought and paid for, still looked like a 1 or 2 year old truck, even though it was 7 year old. And I says, nah, it's finished, I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
So we packed it up there and then, and I did have to go on dole for a few months there in between. But I went into the dole and I says to them, right, I need a job, blah, blah, blah. They say, much money do you need? I say, £300 a week, 15 grand a year. That's what it was at that. Oh, we don't have any jobs like that here. I went, right, okay. So my wife happened to pick up the local paper, came out every Friday. She says, there's an advert in there for Shell. So I had a look at it and I went, that's not for Shell, that's an agency. And then I read it better and I thought, oh no, that's a recruitment agency looking to recruit for Shell. It's not an agency as such. So I applied for it, and apparently there was 2,000 people applied for the 9 jobs, and the rate was rubbish. It was 8,000 less than the men that were already there. And when a lot of them found it, because you were going to hotels and sitting doing silly little tests like you used to get in a colouring book at school, you know, where you would follow the line of the head of the snake and see what snake had hit head and what tail and all that. You think it's silly, but actually it shows you how to... check your hoses are connected at the right end, both ends.
Yeah.
So they weren't as stupid as it seemed. But anyway, a lot of drivers didn't like that. When they found out the wages, they just stopped sticks and left. Because they were getting as much as that, maybe with Duncan Adams and working with, you know, a few nights out a week and stuff like that, which a lot of them liked a few nights a week away. So it ended up, as chance would have it, I got down to the last 21, we got a driving test. And I turned up for the driving test, and the brought a driver trainer up from England. We are holding 4350 in a tandem axle tank. It's a double drive, holding on super singles with this tank on it. And he says to me, have you driven the twin splitter before? I went, no. I says, but I've read about it in magazines. I says, it'll be fine. He says, well, I'll not be judging you on the gearbox anyway. He says, you've been on an Arctic? I went, a while ago. I said, I've been on a rigid for the last 4 years. Right. He says, tell me when you're ready and I'll start judging you. So I fired it up and I drove it out the gate. I says, right, you can start now. He says, how's that? I says, well, I never hit the gate, so I've obviously know the trailer's there, like, you'll be fine. So away we goes, and we're going up. It must be 1 in 8, 1 in 9, something like that, hill called the Avon Gorge. And bang, jumps out of gear going up the Avon Gorge. So I quickly managed to grab a gear, and it was the right gear, and it kept going nice and smoothly. And he says to me, no seen a recovery like that before. He says, and you've never driven a twin splitter? I went, no, but I can count in threes and fours. I says, so, you know, it's not that hard. And he says, that's why I'm no marking you on the gearbox. It's jumping out of gear. As it happened, the whole fleet were jumping out of that gear like it. So I was lucky to have it. Out of the 16, I got the job. And out of that, 21 for the driving test, we were whittled down to 9, got the job. And that was it. So within a year, I'd started some other new guys, and I was given one of them as a trainee. I had him for 5 weeks, still a very good friend of mine now. Yeah, I just kind of took to it like duck to water. Well, had my incidents, of course, but I'll not go into them.
Yep.
But I did 15 and a bit years on the Shell job. We started with Shell originally, and then they say that they cut the rate to keep us in-house as a job for life. And 4.5 years later, we were working for P&O. Now, none of the oil companies work on less than a 5-year plan. So they knew when they started us exactly, it was never a job for life. It was always going to be contracted out.
Yeah.
So contracted to P&O. To be fair, P&O were okay. Really no bad at all. Then Wincanton bought P&O out. Different story. No very good. And Wincanton just dumped the contract because P&O apparently had won the contract and then went back in even cheaper after they'd won it. Just to get some more blue chip customers there, because what happened was they sold the company to Dubai Ports.
Right.
They sold the transport site to Wincanton and then the rest went to Dubai Ports. So Wincanton dropped it like a hot potato and Suckland took it over. I was off long-term sick for a while when Suckland took it over. And to be fair, the local management and everything at Suckland's, it worked very well for a while. And then started to have a bit of disagreement. So I took redundancy. And by this time, I'm importing American cars as a hobby kind of thing. So a mate of mine and I were doing that. Realised it wouldn't stand on its own as a business. And then the mate that I had actually trained on the Shell job, he phones me up one day and he says, Turner, Lewis Tankers are looking for a driver. I went, I'm not really, I'm in dirty working clothes. I'm in the workshop here. So away he goes. The next thing the phone goes, they tell me you're not wanting to come for an interview because you've got dirty clothes on. I says, well, yeah. And the woman says, we had a driver came in here, she's in a shirt and tie. She's, we just laughed him out of the office because he's worked for us before and he should have known better. Just come round here, she says. So I went round and I was met with this big guy bursting out the door with two drivers. And he says to me, I'll not say the words, but more or less, useless idiots, don't know how to start a BMW. Who are you? I says, I'm Jim Horn. Right. And so he comes back in and says, look, if starting a BMW is part of the job, I'm not so sure I know how to do it either, unless it's got a key. he says, it's not got a key. I'll show you. He says, anyway. He says, so you're Jim Horn? I went, aye. He says, can you start tomorrow? I went, is that my interview? He went, aye.
Not a bad interview.
Aye, I says, actually, I can't. How not? I said, I've not got a license. What the fuck are you doing round here then? He says, I says, you phone for me to come round? I says, I'm only answering. I says, my license is in Swansea. I'm 50 years old. It's a way to get renewed. Right, okay. He says, go to the refineries, get your inductions done. He says, and that was it. That was me starting with Tankers. Lewis Tankers. Casual. It was only casual. Filling, a bit of relief when they're busy and stuff like that. And 15 years later, I'm still here.
So did they get bought out by Turners? Because you worked for Turners, weren't you?
That's right, mate. Yeah, Turners took over Lewis Tankers. I think Barry Lewis said to work with Turners as well. He's actually left now, remember, retired now. But yeah, and to be honest with you, Matt, see the stress of being on the Shell job, because the wages did keep up, obviously. But I used to like doing petrol stations, or so I thought. Turned out it was them that were giving me stress, because while I was off with my illness, I was the safety rep, and they asked me to do route risk assessments on every job in Scotland. So I wrote the book on, a new driver could go in and take this laminated sheet out of a book. It would tell them the route to go or a route to go. It would tell them whether he had to phone in advance, whether it was a licensee controlled, a driver and a company delivery, or a driver controlled delivery. And it would tell you where you needed to lay your cones out to keep your safety area, under the health and safety and the patrolling regulations and all that. And they could tell them exactly everything they needed to know, whether they needed to phone anybody in advance, whatever, So
yeah.
I wrote that book, and it turned out that I started falling out with people on sites, customers moving my cones to get to the airline and blocking me in when I'm trying to get out. It turned out I was one of the few that were actually putting the cones out, and I couldn't nobody it because I wrote the book.
Exactly, yeah.
So there was a lot of stress involved there, because you were getting mixed things for your, what the company was starting to say, you can't do that. And I've always been one of them, well, I just get my work done. And they're saying, well, you can't do that. And when you then turn and say, right, well, I'm not doing that, the manager then turns and says, you just did that to spite me. No, I did it because you told me that I'm not allowed to do that anymore. So it became too much for me, Matt. So when redundancy came up, I decided to take it. And as I say, the Lewis thing ever since, totally different management style. I mean, absolutely different. The fact that we've had a few managers in Scotland since, one of them came back twice. But other than one of the ladies we had in there, the rest have all been drivers. They knew the tankers inside out. So they knew what they were talking about. They knew the routes. They knew what they were giving you today, and they knew the problems that could arise. So there was never a problem. Brilliant right. company. People slate them down south. I noticed that on some of the drivers' forums. I can't say anything bad about them. And the job that I was doing, I ended up just doing a shunting job. I loved it because it was only running from storage in Grangemouth docks to the Grangemouth refinery, four trips per shift. Delivering ethanol, you know, the ethanol goes in the petrol at 10% these days, you re-10.
Yeah.
And I was just moving that stuff, moving the stock, and I just kept an eye on the stock at either side so that the refinery would never run out, but the tanks would always be empty at storage for the next boat coming in to replenish them. And I kind of just ran it myself quite a lot. And the company left me to do it. And drivers didn't like it because they're 6 hours a day standing outside the truck, you know, whatever weather you've got, you know. And yeah. very little driving. But it suited me. As I say to the manager, I says, if you piss me off enough, I can always just leave it and walk home. I says, no more than an hour from home. And to my recent manager, who's a good friend, I says, and by the way, you can't go and get it because you've only got a class two. Unfortunately, he's just moved on just as the job I've had has just finished up. And Johnny's just moved on to another company now as well. So when the job finished up, as a casual driver, I've not got any right on anything under the TUPE regulations. But Turners had said that I'd done such a good job for them, and I'm no blowing my trumpet there. This is what they said. They actually tried to get me a job with the people that were taking it over. And when I went for the interview for that job, other people had had to jump through hoops for an interview. I just walked in to get told, right, when do you want to start? More or less. It wasn't even an interview. And I said to them, look, thanks for it, but I'm not wanting it. I says, I don't want to go back. I'm 63 nearly. I don't want to go back to 4 on, 4 off, 3 a.m. starts. And I wasn't guaranteed to be on the job I had been on. So I could be looking to find up to like 100 different deliveries through Scotland again during the next few years. So I thank them very much for the offer. And I've offered them any help if they need any assistance on the job I was doing, because it does have its problems. That they can just phone me and I'll help them out with any of the drivers and help them out with it, you know. And so now I'm just doing things like for Gleaner Oils or that, whereas maybe pick up a load of diesel, take it up to Elgin to the local depot up there and then drop it off. Still casual. I know casual jobs don't suit everybody, but it suited me because, you know, when I'm doing my American cars, if somebody was coming to see a car, I could just say to them, I'm not available. I don't need to book holidays. I just make myself unavailable. As long as I'm not dropping them in it, you know, which I'll never do. I'll never ever do that. It'd be too good for me. And you can see behind me, I've got that Vatican Mac sitting behind me. So when we go to the shows with that, you know, that's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, it can be even longer because I usually stop at Nick Bull's on the way down and on the way back up. So that's
speaking of headaches.
That's just a cancel, yeah. So you're just going very well with him and his family and all their circle of friends as well. And if I was on that new job, I wouldn't be able to do that. I don't have a big social life, but that's part of it. And family coming for dinners twice a week is another part of it. If I was on back shift, I would miss that as well.
Absolutely.
I'm just excited to see where I am.
Fair enough. So what is the story with the Turbo Star then? Because for people who haven't seen it, how did it come about?
I don't know. I just had this stupid thought one day. I woke up one morning and thought, I'm going to collect the trucks that I used to have when I was a small hauler. So I found an F80 in Greece. So I says, I'll have that. So I bought that. Found a Bunny T-Cab 141 in Poland, which I never had, but I liked that. So I'll have that as well. So I bought that. You know, I was selling off all the American cars, so I had a bit of float to play with. So I bought them, imported them. The Scania was needing too much work, so I put it up for sale, and a fairly local guy bought that. He's got a Series 1, 2, and 3 T-Cab now. And I thought, Turbo Star, love to hear Turbo Star. Now, I knew I was never going to get a right-hand drive six-wheeler.
Alan Carruthers, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, Alan Carruthers had one doing near Dumfries, but he wasn't really wanting to sell it at the time that I was wanting to buy it. He's now sold it. But it was a 480. The one I had back in 1988 was a 360. And as a show truck, I'd rather be able to afford to put the diesel in to go to retro rather than, you know, it's an 800-mile round trip to retro. So yeah. I'd rather do that 9 mile of the gallon than 6 mile of the gallon, you know?
Definitely, yeah.
So I just kept an eye on the internet, and then in Italy, up came this TurboStar. I'm looking at it, I thought, wow, that's tidy. Now, okay, it's nothing like the one I had. It's got the 360 in it, but the steering wheel's on the other side, and it's got the fuller 15-speed. Mine had the ZF knocker cross on it, and yeah. It's only a four-wheeler. Mine was a six-wheeler. But I thought, wow, look at the condition of that. 215,000 kilometres on the clock.
Really?
Used. Yep, 1987, 215,000 kilometres. So this was a DiSarnio autocarry down in, way down south past Pisa, a long way down Italy. I can't remember now exactly where it was. And I thought, well, I'll have that. So I messaged them and says, is there anything to come off the price of that? I went, not a chance. I went, aye, okay, I'll send you the money. So it was a really good value for money. So another friend of mine, Ed Turvey, Ed runs about for Sean O'Brien, OB Trucks, run about all of Europe, delivering and picking up trucks. So he got it collected for me, came back in. We got that one in, I think, that came into their yard in England, and Nick Stevens brought it up for me. And I had to unwrap half the plastic off the inside of the car and the top bunk. It had never been used. Driver's seat's got a little bit of wear on it, but apart from that, hardly ever been used, mate.
Oh, you can't turn something like that away just to try and hang on for a potential right-hand drive six-wheeler, which are going to be rare, aren't they? There's not many of them about.
No, they rusted away when they were 4 years old, mate, you know. So I can still put a tag on the back of that, and everybody keeps saying, don't do it, but it's me. It'll happen at some point. Next time I sell an American car, it's happening.
Fair enough. And also we should say that one of your actual original trucks is still about on the preservation circuit as well, isn't it?
Five of them, I think.
Five?
Yeah. Two that I used that were actually in use was Aki Borderer. Now, I sold that to a guy in Carnoustie. After I restored it to primer, rebuilt the cab, restored it to the primer stage, sold it to a guy in Carnoustie. He sold it several times. It ended up with David Donaldson doing it at Athlingborough, who also directly from me bought a Leyland Marathon that I had later on. So he had two of my trucks there. he's going to restore the Marathon. The Aki's now ended up back in Carnwath. A guy called Robbie Watt has it now, who's on the restoration circuit with various trucks. That's being rebuilt. So that's on the go. And of course, everybody knows the guy, Big J, that Richard Stanier has, the sleeper cab, the 180, again. Strange vehicle, no register till 1985, built in 1978, so it's on a B reg, very low miles when I bought it. We got it painted as well, so I think it left me in 1992, and Richard's had it ever since. It's still in the same colours, except, you know, it's black, and instead of having the tartan band, he just painted the tartan into red, because obviously he's no Scottish. So it's still got my tartan curtains in it, though. So Richard has that, and then, of course, I've met Richard 18 times since then. Facebook's been a wonderful thing for finding old friends.
Definitely.
It's cost me a bloody lot of money in trucks and stuff like that. Otherwise, probably would never have bothered with it again, you know. but I kept a lot of stuff back, so that truck's on the go. And then, of course, the other ones that you've maybe seen, the ERF, that's the Chapel Cross Flyer, dark green, big crew cab, ERF KV, British Nuclear Fuels. I bought that to restore, never got round to it, but that's on the circuit now. My Bedford RL, I bought a Bedford RL with 1,111 miles on the clock, and we just ran about locally up here with it, but that's still on the go. And what was the other one? I can't remember, there was another one. Maybe just that the Marathon's going to go back on the road, but I never really used that for work, you know, that was just something else. Oh, my ERF, forgetting about my ERF ECX that I bought when we were moving yards with the cars. I got it with a low loader so I could move all my stuff about. Mm-hmm. So it was used locally just. Brandon Jinks has that now and it's absolutely minted. It's a metallic sort of burgundy candy apple red colour.
Oh, yeah, I know the one.
Yeah, you know the one I mean. Yeah, that was me. We actually used that to build the shed that I'm sitting in now. It was such a thing to try and build. It's one of the air raid shelter, aircraft hangar type shelter.
Yeah.
And we actually built the truck with a fence on the top of our curtain cider, the exact height of the garage, so as we could make up the arches on the floor, stand on this, pull them up with a rope and tie them to the top of the truck to keep it secure until we actually had enough of them standing that the garage wouldn't blow away, because the garage is only done at nights and weekends with friends, you know, the health and safety involved, obviously. But so we used it for that as well. And so Brandon's got that now. So I've now also got a 112 that, when it gets painted, will be dedicated to Andrew, the fellow that lost his life in my 112. That's a hard purchase to go and revisit that again, but I felt it had to be done at the end of the day. It's part of the history, like it or loathe it, and, you know, put Andrew's name on it, Andrew's being remembered on it. So I bought that off Nick Bull, a good price, and then another mate of mine, Bullet, brought it up the road for us. So that's waiting just to come into the workshop now to start getting welded up, because the cab's in a bit of a mess. We'll get there. It'll not be a Concourse restoration. It will be a working clothes, working truck type restoration.
Yeah,
lovely. As will the F88, because if they're going on low loaders, it's to save diesel. It's not to be a show queen. None of mine were show. In fact, that F88, the cab's quite rough on that, and I could just throw some black paint into it now and it would look exactly like the one I had back in 1988. I mean, that APA was so reliable, but the two times it did let me down, we were in actually three times, but we were in Barcelona and a mate with me, and we walked back to it to find this water leak, and he says, oh, that's leaking water. So we tipped the cab up, and the compressor head had went porous, the little jet of water coming out of it, and he went, oh my god, that needs a compressor. And I says, well. So we got a rubber grommet, one of the blanking grommets you blank a hole off with.
Yeah, yeah.
And the indentation, they just filled it up with instant gasket and then cable tied it around the compressor head. And he says to me, you think that'll get us home? I says, well, it'll be a try. I says, the worst thing that's going to happen is the cable ties will break and we'll maybe need to do it again. It was still there 7 years later when I sold it. And then we were driving, my uncle was on it and I'm on the TurboStar, and we get near Bordeaux. Well, we're actually at Clodge, and I says, I can smell hub oil out of that. Sure enough, a hub oil seal was away. So we went into Volvo at Bordeaux the next morning, bought a hub oil seal, into customs at a run, knew I would be there 3 hours. So I did the hub oil seal while we were waiting on customs. So away we went to this inland oil well in the middle of nowhere in Spain. Very scenic. I've got a lot of pictures of the narrow, twisty road. It's just looks like some of the roads the guys doing out through Turkey used to experience in the summer, at least. And I was photographing them coming through a village when they come back, and I could smell that gear oil again. I do have made an arse of putting that oil seal. So I jumped underneath it, and here was this hole on the side of the diff, about 4 inches.
Oh, dear.
The F88 has a double reduction diff, you know, it has the pinion, then a crown wheel, then another one behind it. And the middle one had thrown the bearing right out. Well, that's not going anywhere now.
No.
So, we just left it where it was, sitting at a wee petrol station at the side of the road in the middle of nowhere. Said to the guy, keep an eye on that, I'll be back in a week. So we double manned the TurboStar down to Valencia, loaded tiles, tipped at Glasgow, up to the local breakers, got a diff of 88, back to Scunthorpe, put an ATA carney on the diff, got the load out, tipped it over to where the truck was, diff out, diff in. Back to Valencia, loaded the two of them home again. Job done. No issues.
Just like that.
There was bloody cold. There was 10 inches of snow when we're taking the dip. It's all sunny. It's no sunny in the north.
No, definitely not.
So sure enough, that was the only other time it let me down. Cracking old motor. And that's why, as I say, I bought another FAA. And it's a 240 the same, or a 260 as the foreign ones were, left-hand drive, tag axle. Although the one I've got an earlier cab on it, that's the style without the roof vent, no air stack, and the air wipers that are at the top of the screen. So I'd like to actually, if I could have, I would have sold that, bought a later one so it was more like the one I had. But, you know, as we said, Matt, you're not going to worry about details when you're just trying to recreate something for a long time ago.
When it's just for a bit of fun, really, isn't it?
When you're not a big budget, massive, big haulage contractor, you're just... you're doing the work yourself, for starters. and yeah. you're doing it on a shoestring. Pretty much how my haulage game went, right from start to finish, on a shoestring. a wing and a prayer.
Fair enough. So where should we see you this year then, Jim? Obviously the retro show. Have you got any other sort of planned?
No, really. We've got some family health issues this year. I'm supposed to be in London right now and maybe going to a surprise party for somebody when I was down there. I might still make that. I'll need to phone. I'm going to phone my mate Nick Brew and see if he's still going. If he is, I'll probably go. We just have a family member that's in the last few days.
So we're
having to work around about that. Therefore, we're not doing the London thing. So Nick Brew has his... a lot of people know about his losing his daughter at 12-year-old with cancer. And he organised a sort of music festival last year. And, you know, people just turned up in their trucks and slept in his yard and went to the little music festival. This year, the music festival's in his yard. So I'll be down there. That's in August. Yeah. All the proceeds go to the Sheffield Children's Hospital there, where they looked after young Daisy. She's there on the cup there. That's the thing we're there. So we do that, and I'll do retro. And last year, we also had a show. It was at one of Pat Collins Fun Fairs events with the Monster Trucks. And they asked us to do a little, I asked Nick Rahat to do a little show, and we had about 50 trucks there. Ian Rogers they put a lot of trucks into it, you know. And if we're having that this year, we'll be doing that as well. But this is the good thing about having a friend and like Nick in Retford. I'll take the truck to the first one and leave it there, and I'll get the train up and down to his. And the truck doesn't need to keep coming back and forth to Scotland, that extra sort of 600 mile round trip doesn't need to happen. Yeah. It saves a lot of diesel.
Definitely.
Because in Hogmanay this year, we've got the yard broken into, and all the diesel we're taking out of all the trucks. Ugh. So, of course, you only put enough in to leave it lying in the yard. And then since what's happened, the war in the Middle East has sent the prices soaring, and it's now something like £1,100 to fill the tank on that Iveco.
Yeah.
So, you know, if that guy hadn't stole the diesel, the truck would have been filled up before the war started. But he just made me lose any confidence in leaving diesel in the trucks in the yard, you know.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Nah, it wasn't a good thing. And between that and then losing my wee dog on the 6th of January, it's no been a good year so far, Matt. So,
you know,
I'm looking forward to what few shows we are going to do. We're good friends. Yeah. I mean, you've seen what happens at a retro. You know yourself. If you're lucky, you get an hour to walk around the trucks. The rest of the things... It's just party time, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
You've seen it, you know. We have a massive cookout. We have a bar. Anybody's welcome.
We shall imbibe in a couple of beverages, no doubt, won't we?
I would imagine so, mate. Yeah. I've always got a couple of big fridges going there, hooked up to big truck batteries, you know, and they're always full. And there's always reserves to go in them as well, you know.
That's the most important thing.
No, as an aside, one of my managers for Turner's actually goes to them as well, with a Scania, with his son. And we have a drink there as well, like, you know.
Oh, excellent.
And he's actually up here now as my temporary manager while we're looking for a new manager. So he's normally the training manager. But yeah. Turner's is a bit to do with the old trucks as well. I mean, Tim King, you've seen his F88 going about there. Well, Tim's the fleet engineer with Turner's.
Yeah, I met him once, only very briefly. I do a little bit of trade plate for DAF, and we used to deliver all the Turner's brand new trucks into Soham. Mm-hmm. So he was there because that's in his little 88s and 86 in Griggs colours, isn't it?
It is, that's right. Yeah. And the 88, I can't remember his colours, but that 88 has used to belong to John Williams. It used to run the Middle East. It was in that Astran in the Destination Doha film, John Williams.
Yeah.
Well, that truck, that F88 was John Williams' truck. So that's got a lot of history as well. And then due to my sort of relationship with Turner's, whenever we're finished with all trucks up here, I buy the tractor units.
Fair enough.
I make sure I drive it so I know what it's like, and then I can make an honest appraisal when I'm going to sell it.
Yeah,
so I do a deal with Turner's via Tim. We buy the truck, I clean them up, and I sell them on.
Fair enough.
It's just another thing. You know, the relationship with Turner's has been so good.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I think I've taken up enough of your time, Jim, because you've got stuff to be getting on with.
I'm just going to do something I'm not really wanting to do, try and rig up the air horns on this Iveco.
Fair enough.
That means drilling another two holes in the roof.
Hey, there's nothing like it.
Nothing like it. You get that wrong, that's it. Yeah.
Absolutely, mate. Well, it's been great to chat to you, Jim. And if I don't speak to you before, which I'm sure I will, especially as Popmaster's on daily.
Yes.
Then
average, I'm beating you on that, you know, on average.
Oh, yes, I'm well aware of that, thank
but,
you.
But then again, we've got to trust each other, we're no cheating.
That's true. Well, you've seen my scores. I'm pretty sure you know I'm not cheating.
Yeah, well, I'm no either with mine. But the problem with that Popmaster, though, is probably the two is they cheat slightly. If the contestant's too quick with their answer,
yes,
they're blocking it out while you're, you know, putting it out there.
Yeah.
And you have to think to yourself, right, was I going to get that as quick as that? Or was he said it as quick as that?
Yeah.
Even though, yeah, on reflection, you knew the answer. Would I get it as quick as that, you know? So, admittedly, I do claim the ones if I thought I was going to get it and the guy blocked me out too quick, as long as I've got it within the time.
Yeah, definitely.
I just wish I could block out their answers so that it would make it a bit easier, but, you know, a bit more upfront, you know, but there you go.
There we go.
And, so, if not, anyway. I'll see you at Retro then.
Yes, mate, yes, you'll see me at the Retro.
And you've not written any of your books, so I've not got anything for you to devalue with your signature, so...
No, I don't know if I've signed your Kepstone one, have I?
Oh, no, of course I could bring that, will I?
I'll bring that down, yeah. I'll devalue that, mate, yeah. I'll devalue that, not a problem at all.
Brilliant.
Lovely job. Well, thanks ever so much, Jim.
All the best to you, Matt.
We'll speak to you soon. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.